So, friends, as already announced, the topic of today's discussion, short talk, is freedom, rights and duties. This is in the context of the Independence Day that we will be celebrating on August 15th, that is tomorrow. So we will examine the ideas of freedom, rights and duties. So in 1947, India, the present day India, obtained freedom from colonial rule. And it is interesting to remember that Britishers came to India as traders. They did not come as conquerors, but they came as traders, as merchants. So today, after 64 years, we claim that India has been free from colonial rule. But all thinking men have to ask this question: are we really free? Are we really free as individuals? Are we really free as a nation? And also ask the question, what is meant by freedom itself? If we examine the state of affairs today, we'll find that colonial rule is gone in one form, but it has returned in another form. The old colonial rule, where foreigners came and ruled our countrymen, was easy to perceive. It is easy to see foreigners entering our nation, making rules and ruling us. It is easy to perceive that. It is easy to recognize it. It is easy to recognize that oppression. But this new colonialization is invisible, intangible, and corrodes the nation from within outwards. From within outwards. This is the horrors of the economic colonialization. And we see the horrific consequences of this economic colonialization, wherein power is concentrated in the hands of few, and many are oppressed, and injustice is done. Violence and looting of not only fellow beings, but looting of the nature itself. And as it is usually said, the rich keep getting richer and the poor keep getting poorer. So we see that, rather, a thinking person has to ask, who in this country is really free, and what is freedom itself? When millions and millions are oppressed and only few are benefited at the cost of the many, then what is this freedom that we have? That is a question that should be, and that is a question that should be asked by each one of us. And if you look at this concept of freedom itself, the yearning for freedom, the yearning for self-expression, it is innate in all beings, fundamentally present in all creatures. Even the smallest of the insect, a cockroach, or any other insect, asserts its rights in its own sphere of action. It protects itself, it asserts itself. And we see the huge trees outside, and if you put an obstacle for its natural growth, you see that the roots will grow such that it will break away obstacles, whether it is a wall of a house or a cement footpath or anything. So there is a natural tendency towards self-expression, natural tendency towards freedom of expression. And we find this in animals also. And in the case of man, this tendency of freedom and independence and choice making facility becomes intensified because man is a self-conscious being. Man is a reflective being. Self-reflective consciousness is present in man, unlike other kingdoms of nature. So this tendency for independence and freedom and independent thought, self-expression is very, very intensified because of the complex nature of human mind. And looking at the idea of rights, first thing that comes to our mind is the rights that is bestowed on the citizens of a country by the constitution of that particular nation. US has in its constitution, it says that all men have the right of life, liberty and pursuit of happiness. The right of life, liberty and pursuit of happiness. And 62 years ago, in 1949, UN adopted the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a very significant milestone. And many years ago, many years before that, the Declaration of Emancipation, where Abraham Lincoln abolished slavery, and that was another great milestone in the development of humankind. So who is it that confers these rights upon each of us? Who gives us these rights? All the rights that we speak about, all the rights that we know and that we exercise, who gives us these rights? Thomas Paine makes a very profound statement when he says that rights need not be bestowed upon a particular individual, but the very existence of that individual. He says to this effect that the very existence of that individual means that there are rights which are embedded in him, rights which are present in him inherently by the very fact of a person's or a creature's existence. It means it has particular rights. But what should not be overlooked while considering this topic is that the exercise of one's right should not infringe upon others' ability to exercise their rights. Me exercising my rights should not in the slightest manner violate or negate the ability of another creature to exercise its right. And we find the great Italian reformer Joseph Mancini, after the Rights of Man and the French Revolution happened, he wrote this series of essays called as The Duties of Man. He wrote it to the Italian public to bring it to their mind, to bring to their mind the fact that it is not only rights that a person has. It is not only exercise of rights that must be concentrated upon, but there are inherent duties which should be performed by each being. So he says in his essays that the world is overtaken by this idea of individual rights, assertion of rights. But remember that each right has its own corresponding duty. So it's a very, very important statement. So it so appears, if we think about rights and duties and freedom, which is our topic of discussion today, that freedom and rights can never be understood completely without the light of duty falling upon them. If freedom is misunderstood, that a being can behave and do whatever he wants, whatever he likes, and if exercise of right means unrestrained use of one's rights, then there is a problem, because it necessarily violates and infringes upon another's ability to exercise his rights. So freedom and rights should always be guided by duties. And interestingly, these ideas of declaration of rights, exercising of individual rights, assertion of rights, safeguarding one's rights, this appears to be primarily a Western idea. This you don't find in the Eastern cultures. Exercising of rights, assertion of rights, and safeguarding individual rights appears to be primarily a Western idea, which has grown in the recent past, especially after the Church Christianity has developed. Even the ancient sages of the West, like Plato, Plotinus, Porphyry, the Neoplatonists, all of them spoke of duties. It is interesting to note this, that the assertion of rights is a recent development, and too much focus and prominence to individual rights is a recent development. By the advent of Church Christianity, mind you, not the Christianity of Jesus, by the Church Christianity, because even Jesus speaks about the duties of man in his Sermon on the Mount and all other places. He says what man ought to do. So with the advent of the Church Christianity and its horrifying consequences, which we see in the dark ages of Europe, and how the scientific thought and the French Revolution overthrew the church powers, it appears that the rights have taken the primary and first place during that phase onwards. Because man is seen as separate from each other. I am separate, you are separate. So I have my rights, I have to exercise it. You are separate, you have your rights, you should exercise it. I will safeguard my rights because there is a possibility that you will violate it. So there is a constitution that is enshrined, and then a regulating authority who will take care that one doesn't infringe upon another. So this separate idea of man, one person being separate from another, so this idea of right seems to be arising from that idea of separateness. And the fear that there is external forces, for example, another person who might work for my downfall, so I have to safeguard my thing, so I have to safeguard my rights. So these are the ideas which are associated with assertion of rights and prominence to rights. But Look at the ancient, compare this with the ancient teachings, with the ancient culture, the ancient traditions. They looked beyond the appearance. They looked beyond what is appearance and saw the reality of things. They saw how the inner nature works. Whereas our modern science sees the physical nature as the only reality, and thus from those ideas are built your constitutional constitution and all other social and economic philosophies built on that, the ancients looked beyond the physical nature and saw what is the reality behind this appearance. So they saw and recognized the inner workings of nature. And therefore, it appears that it was not rites that all of us were asked to assert. Their teachings always spoke about the duties to be performed. You'll find this in all scriptures. You don't find you are capable of doing this, go ahead and do it, but what is it that man ought to do? What is that ideal way of living? That is what is given in all the scriptures. What a man ought to do. So there is enumeration of right, enumeration of duties, not declarations of rights. And this is a very, very, very important distinction that we see, because the ancients very well knew, by looking into the workings of nature, that when duties are taken care of, rights are automatically taken care of. If a being completely performs his duty in the best manner possible, then his rights are automatically guarded. He need not assert his right. His rights are automatically taken care of. What belongs to him is automatically given.
What are the duties?
We'll come to that. Duty is that which is due to humanity. Duty is that which is due to other fellow men. And just like Thomas Paine said, that the very fact of the existence of a person implies there are rights imbibed in him, there are rights inherent in him, so also the very fact that we exist among this collection of beings, interconnected, interdependent, affecting each other each moment, implies that there are duties to be performed. We affect each other in various ways, and we are inseparably bound with one another. Each day, if you just examine your daily life, you will see that for your life to work the way it has been working, innumerable people are doing their job, innumerable people are sacrificing, innumerable creatures are working and doing their duties so that you may be happy, so that your life may proceed. So it implies duty to family, duty to your countrymen, duty to the humanity as a whole, duty to nature, not just humankind, all the other creatures, myriads of creatures. And primarily, it implies duty to one's own divinity, duty to the God that is within each one of us. There is a divine spark that is within each one of us. The only God that a man can seek and find is within himself. So there is a primary duty to that divine self. And this duty is the highest, which harmonizes all other duty to our family, countrymen, as a citizen, as a part of the human family, as a friend, as a husband or as a wife, as a son, as a father. All these duties are harmonized when the duty to one's own divinity is first perceived. So it encompasses all other duties and sheds that clear light on all the things which a man has to do in his life. Look at what Krishna says in the Gita about this subject. He says in chapter 3, third chapter, "He who, sinfully delighting in the gratification of his passions, does not cause this wheel thus already set in motion to continue revolving, liveth in vain, O son of Prita." That is, if you don't perform this daily duty of reciprocity, this daily duty of brotherhood, daily duty of giving back to your fellow men, to nature, giving back with gratitude, at least as much as what we have received, if not more, if we don't keep this wheel revolving, then your life itself is vain. You may be a millionaire, the world may see you as a role model, but in its true worth, your life is a vain thing. It becomes a useless thing. It becomes an encumbrance. It becomes a burden for you if you don't perform this duty of reciprocity.
Reciprocity.
We'll see that. We'll consider that. Which is why the teacher say, of all the worst sins, all the various sins and crimes that are there, the worst of them is ingratitude. Ingratitude is the worst sin.
Yeah.
And it is said that those who see the inner workings of nature say that when a person takes something and is ungrateful and he doesn't give back, then the whole nature thrills and cries in revolts against such a person. Such is the power of ingratitude. So what are these duties that we need to perform? What is meant by keeping this wheel revolving? The best answer to this is given by the sage Patanjali in the Yoga Aphorisms. And doing these duties is yoga. Yoga is not physical exercise. It is not control of breath. Yoga, which the ancient teachers showed, is performance of these duties. So what are these duties? He begins with forbearance, yama. Let me read what are these duties. He says, forbearance consists in not killing, veracity, not stealing, continence, and not coveting. So you are asking, what are the duties? These are the duties. And look at what he says next. These five, what he mentioned, without respect to rank, place, time, or compact, are the universal great duties. He doesn't say that these duties are only for yogis. Not killing, veracity, not stealing, continence, not coveting. Truth, speaking the truth. Speaking truth. All these five are the duties of all beings, whatever may be his situation in life, of whatever caste, whatever religion, whatever his condition. These, he says, are universal great duties. So this is what has to be followed. These are the duties.
Coveting
is greed. Not coveting is not being greedy. And if we analyze these duties, if we think about these duties, which are universal, which all of us need to perform at all times, then you find the beauty of it, that it fundamentally guards your rights. You need not worry about your rights. Your rights is automatically taken care of. It is self-guarding. It doesn't violate others' rights. It safeguards your rights. Practicing these virtues, which are duties, safeguards others' rights and your rights. And one of our friends used to quote from Mahabharata, where Dharmaraya is asked this question: you always speak of dharma, why should one follow dharma? Why should one follow these duties? So Dharmaraya makes a reply that dharma is there to be followed, to the effect that dharma is there to be followed because of its own sake. It doesn't need any other reason why you should follow dharma. It's self-explanatory. And let's look further into a couple of these duties and try to understand how this safeguards our rights and why these are important. First is, he spoke about ahimsa, not killing. Right? Not killing doesn't mean only physical killing. Killing doesn't mean only physical killing. Ahimsa or himsa is in our mind. Ahimsa or himsa is in our mind, where our very thought of vengeance or hatred or ill will, as we see in the Dhammapada, those very thoughts are violence. So ahimsa is in mind. Ahimsa doesn't, just because I'm a vegetarian doesn't mean I am ahimsavad. It is in mind, it is in heart, it is in those feelings that we have towards others, especially towards our enemies. Especially towards our enemies. So ahimsa is there. So let's see what he says further. When harmlessness and kindness are fully developed in the yogi, that is, when a being consummates this ahimsa completely, such that he is the very epitome, the very expression of ahimsa, then what happens? What is the siddhi that he gets? When harmlessness and kindness are fully developed in the yogi, there is a complete absence of enmity, both in men and animals, among all that are near to him. Look at what happens. If a person is able to attain to this state of complete ahimsa, then everything around him, whether it is wild beast or the most criminal person, everything around him will be constitutionally incapable of harming him. So he need not, such a person need not take the help of a government to assert his right and gain his security. Whatever country he is, whatever place he is, whether he is in the lion den or in the midst of a riot or in the midst of criminals, wherever he is, or in the midst of wild beast, poisonous snakes, wherever he is, nature itself guards his rights because he has done his duty. Duties are taken care of by the individual, rights are taken care of by the nature itself. So, he just needs to take care of himself. The ancients understood this, that anything that comes to man by way of fortune or misfortune, by way of pain or pleasure, by way of any circumstances that we face in life, comes because the roots, the seed for such a thing exist within us. So they always insisted on self-reformation. not outside social reformation of changing the political laws or the economic laws. They spoke about self-reformation. Dalai Lama gave a very nice answer to one of his inquirers, where he says that you take care of your mind, everything else will be taken care of. Which means you take care of yourself and do the duties that you ought to do, and everything that has to happen to you will happen right. This is what is a Vedic saying, that dharmo rakshati rakshita. And there is one very nice story in Mahabharata of the interaction between Yaksha and Yudhishthira, Yaksha and Dharmaraya. So we all know about story about how Yaksha Prashne happened. So the Pandavas are thirsty, they go, one of them goes to get water, then the Yaksha asks questions, Nakula doesn't answer and tries to grab water, he is killed. Similarly, all the Yudhishthira's brothers are killed. And then Yudhishthira himself goes, and then Yudhishthira doesn't try to grab water and go away, but answers Yaksha's prashna in the most wonderful manner. And finally, Yaksha says, okay, Dharmaraya, I am very happy with all your answers. As promised, I will bring back to life one of your brother. Whom do you choose? Choose anyone. I will bring him back to life. Yudhishthira says, bring Nakula back to life. Then Yaksha asks him, it is a very well known truth that Bhima is your most favorite brother. And Bhima has the power of 16,000 elephants. He will be able to protect you from anybody and anything. Why don't you want him? Why don't you revive him from death? Or why don't you choose Arjuna, whose skill with weapons is unsurpassed? He'll be able to protect you. Why don't you choose either Bhima or Arjuna? Then Yudhishthira answers Yaksha that the only protection of man is dharma. It is not Bhima or Arjuna that will protect a man, but it is dharma that will protect a man. And then he goes on to explain why he chose Nakula and why it is right according to dharma, and why he would choose dharma rather than his personal preference of this brother or that brother. So we have such marvelous examples in our scriptures and in our traditions, which speak about the importance of duties. As a very wise man once said that I never had to take care of my rights, I just had to take care of my duties. Rights were taken care of by themselves. And this is what we see in Mahabharata, that Pandavas unjustly, their kingdom is grabbed by the Kauravas, and they don't return it back to the Pandavas, and then for the sake of freedom and the right of the individual and their family, they engage in a lawful war. Now at the beginning of the war, Arjuna, who is enthused and full of energy to wage this war for the sake of freedom and rights and win this war, he breaks down because the path of duty was not understood, which is the sequence when Krishna begins to enumerate the path of duty, which we find in as the Bhagavad Gita. All the 18 chapters of the Bhagavad Gita explain this path of duty in various means, at various stages of man, at various stages of his development. What are the things that he need to do? So this is very beautifully explained in the Gita. And further, let's consider one more verse from the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali, and then we'll leave some time for discussion. After speaking of the effect of perfecting in one duty, which is ahimsa, he enumerates what happens when the other duties are perfected. And let's consider this: not stealing. He says, when abstinence from theft in mind and act, that is, his mind doesn't even desire another's possession, forget about working and trying to grab it, even in his feelings he is free from attachment to another's objects. As Baswanna once said, that it is not poisonous snakes that I'm afraid of, it is not wild beast and ferocious animals that I'm afraid of. What I'm afraid of is two things: paradhana and parastri. So when abstinence from theft in mind and act is complete in the yogi, he has the power to obtain all material wealth. That is, he becomes the possessor of everything in nature. Everything in nature belongs to him. There is nothing that nature can hold back from him. There is no bars of nature which will stop him from taking anything. Of course, because he has overcome this delusion of separateness. Because he has become constitutionally incapable of, even in mind, a single thought of selfishness wouldn't arise in him. So he has reached that high perfection, and when he has reached it, everything is open for him. All the riches of nature is open for him. He becomes the possessor of all. So we find that freedom, duties and rights, these are just very few stray thoughts on these three and how they are related. So these three are actually interconnected. You cannot consider one of these without considering the other two. When the whole humanity accomplishes its duty individually and collectively, then equal rights is granted to all. Equal rights is, all beings can exercise their equal rights, and freedom from bondage happens. Freedom from bondage of conditioned existence. As in the Viveka Chudamani, Shankara says, he answers to the question, what is bondage? Bondage is the feeling that, bondage is this feeling of confusing what is self with what is not self. That is bondage. There lies the cause for bondage, which is expressed in the various kinds of oppression and bondage that we see in the political world, in the social world, in the economic world. So the cause lies there. The cause lies deep within each one of us, where what is real is confused with what is real, unreal, and what is false and ugly and evil is mistaken to be what is true and good. So there, deep within each one of us, lies the cause of bondage and the means of liberation. We need not search it outside in any revolutions that happen, any movement against corrupt individuals to overthrow them. All those are fine, but temporary. It doesn't solve the problem at all, because the problems lies, the cause of bondage lies within each one of us. Unless it is removed and cured there by understanding one's own real nature as being a divine being, one's own inner self being the same as the self of all, unless this knowledge is consummated, unless that free self in us is realized, there is no hope for any kind of external bondage, external liberation or independence which can lead to happiness. Oh, friends, we'll stop here and we can consider any questions. Yeah, you had a questions. Probably that was answered during. You had a few questions that were.
Duties are mentioned. Only some 4-5 duties mentioned.
He mentions still more. He mentions still more, but let's try to first understand this first level of first level of Yama, let us understand. Then comes Niyama and other things. So in our daily life, if we can, to whatever little extent, if we can do this, then we can be sure that our life is not in vain, as Krishna says. It's something worthy that we have added. It's something. Yeah, please.
I'm offered not of wild angles and something.
Yeah.
And then what you told actually that word I didn't get.
Yeah. The verse is from the Yoga Aphorisms of Patanjali. Let me read that verse.
It means
he's a Kannada poet, reformer, great reformer. It means others' wealth and others' woman. These are the two things that I fear the most. Trying, if my mind wanders towards either of these things, it does me much, much more harm than a lion eating.
Others' wealth and others?
Others' woman, others' wife. So he is afraid of that. He says he is afraid of that, not anything else. That is the most harmful thing. Translate it. So in English.
When we eat our food, when we acquire or when we do our work job, we'll bring our money or some kinds. We bring it, whether we actually hard, we worked hard to earn that food, daily life, or it is from the what is called
exploiting others
yeah. by somewhere some hook or crook.
Yeah.
So when we brought the food, if it is really done with our hard work, our genuinity, satya, ahimsa, all these things, if we performed in our duty, then it is really sattvic. It is the what is called Naveno Devastan Kogi Prasada. It becomes Prasada. If it is not done by hard work or individual effort and all, if we exploit others, the ignorant, innocent people in the society, then it becomes a poison. It's a burden. We have to repay back to the nature and the person whom you have exploited in this life or in future life. So in that condition we may borrow to repay back the what we earned by hook or crook or employing other people. That is the gist.
Actually, one thing what I felt, we know actually that you also told and we also that we have to do our duties. And our duty is like that we have not to hurt others' feeling and whatever. We have not to hurt others. And also one wise man, actually he says that our freedom comes to an end where the nose of others starts. Where the nose of others starts. Suppose if I am going on the way and if some other person is coming along the way on the same road, one person has to compromise. Whether he has to come this side, whether that person has to come side, that side. So freedom your freedom comes to an end, there the news of others starts. One thing what I felt, that is okay, we understood, because everywhere we go, we understood that these are the basic things which we have to learn. What I actually get problem, knowing is one part, and executing the thing, that is other part. So my question, that knowing that is okay, like you also gave and from you and from so many like books and so many things are there, we know a lot of things. Knowing is one part, that is okay, I also do and you and like, but how to execute?
How to execute? So let me repeat your question, that we all hear these things, very nice things, but how do we execute it?
Because wherever we go, we get something, you do this thing, you do that thing, and Gita, Ramayana, Mahabharata, so many like epics and books are there. And we also understood that no, we should not hurt others, but still we are doing. After knowing the thing, still we are doing. Then what is, like how we, what execution we have to do, that after that we will be able, that we will not be doing those things.
Yeah, we heard the question.
About our interest, if we execute these things.
No, sir, we'll consider this question. We'll consider.
He has asked question, he must respond. Yes, he can ask.
We'll consider this question. One thing that occurs to mind is that when all these virtues are spoken of, if we don't understand the scientific basis for these ethics, if we just take it as an emotional goodness, then we would definitely fail. We may carry it for some time, we may carry it to some intensity, but we'll definitely fail because our passions and our lower nature will overthrow all these good intentions and bury all our good intentions. But if we understand the science behind these virtues, if we understand the metaphysics behind ethics, if we understand the knowledge which is there behind the action that we are supposed to perform, ahimsa and all that, which means, why do we need to do? When that science of life is studied, then gradually, the more and more we study, an inner change occurs. That science of life, that knowledge, that jnana, should be studied. And it should be put into practice with whatever level of success that we are able to achieve. Just because we are failing a million times doesn't mean that this path has to be abandoned. In the 18th chapter, Krishna says that all human acts are tainted with faults, with errors. But don't abandon the path of duty. Don't abandon the path of duty. It is by gradually, one, deep study of the teachings of the ancient rishis, the ancient teachers, which brings about an inner transformation, and constant practice, which leads to automatically over the course of time that we begin to get away from what is untrue and what is bad and what is evil. And our mind naturally inclines towards what is good because we have been constantly giving it that tendency. Currently what has happened, our tendency is downwards. Why do we fail? Why do we fail after some time? Because we are constantly energizing our mind with such thoughts and such ideas which are contrary to what is real. So jnana, study of the ancient teachings of the Buddhas and Christs, profound study of that brings about an inner transformation, which is the first step. And that jnana leads, and that vichara and jnana leads to vairagya as the next next natural step.
Yeah.
Jnana leads to vairagya.
Doing the same work like in a continuous way. Yeah.
With
right intention.
With the right knowledge, not merely intention, the right knowledge. Why do we need to do? Do we understand the scientific basis for these ethics? Ahimsa is said as a very great virtue. But do we understand why that rests? We can't go into the details of that, but that rests upon the fact that we are not separate.
We are not separate
from each other. If we understand that science of what is man, how each one of us are interconnected, not merely theoretically, but a deep study of that philosophy which the teachers have given, then your mind begins to automatically dissociate itself deep within from what is evil, from what is bad, and tend towards good. Then that inner transformation occurs, wherein you will find yourself naturally inclining towards doing good over a course of time, which is what Buddha says, that purification of mind. Don't think that by doing some practices here and there you will be able to purify your mind. It is so tedious and so long drawn that it is like emptying an ocean with a blade of grass. Drop by drop, you empty the ocean with a blade of grass. So it is so long drawn. The only hope is in knowledge. The only hope is in study of the ancient teachings. Friends, we have come to the end of our time. And next Sunday, we have a short talk at the same time, that is 6:15 p.m. on the subject, the message of Sri Krishna. What is the message of Sri Krishna? That is what we will consider on 21st of August at 6:15 in the same hall.